I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. We all know the quote from astronaut Neil Armstrong. This month marks 50 years since he and Buzz Aldrin took the first steps on the moon in the Apollo 11 mission. Today, a NASA Hall of Famer shares his role in the monumental mission and breaks down what it took to land three men on the moon. Then, commuters throughout Northeast Kansas may have seen the work of Kansas City artist Benjamin Todd Willis floating through the sky. That's because his medium lately has been a balloon-powered camera. It's not a bird or a plane, it's art. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Here's the stone-cold reality of where America found itself in the early 1960s. The President of the United States was promising to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade, and the country had absolutely no idea how to do it. The idea of landing a man on the moon by 1970 has been called the impossible mission, and for good reason. Now, a conversation about the challenges that the moon mission presented, America's scientific community, and how they were overcome. Our conversation, by the way, comes a day prior to the 50th anniversary of the day that Apollo's Eagle landed on the lunar surface. With us, Lynn Bondurant is back. He's a retired NASA Educational Programs Officer and a 1961 graduate of Park University. Bondurant was a 2016 inductee into NASA's Glenn Research Center Hall of Fame, which recognizes individuals who had a far-reaching influence on the direction and mission of the center. Lynn, it's a pleasure to have you back again. Welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be back. It's always fun to get to Kansas City.
Good deal. Let's go back to May 25th, 1961. That's the day that President Kennedy declared that America should commit itself to landing a man on the moon before the decade was out. How ready was this country to carry out that mission on that day?
Well, they weren't ready. I can speak from experience. I was at the Goddard Space Flight Center in 1967. And when that was announced, number one, they didn't know what the moon's surface was like. Mm-hmm. So they had to develop a Ranger spacecraft, and one is on display at the Science City. So you can see the, I think it's a Ranger 7. Then they had the lunar orbiter, and finally the Surveyor spacecraft. And those three different spacecraft provided the information that was necessary to select the landing sites for the upcoming Apollo missions.
You know, wasn't there some concern, just reading a lot about this, because I find the entire topic absolutely absorbing. There was some concern, at least by at least one prominent scientist, that when the lunar module descended to the moon, that it might sink up to its nostrils in dust because we didn't really quite know what the surface was made of.
That's correct. And the Surveyor, one of them, or several of them, had a scoop that they could actually go down and dig a trench and measure the bearing strength. And it was sufficient that the lunar module could land on it. And after the Apollo 11 astronauts actually landed, one of the first things they had to do, and it was Buzz Aldrin's responsibility to determine how can an astronaut move through what's called the regolith, the loose materials on the surface of the moon. And he ran around and, you know, did different things, and actually one of the most famous pictures is the boot print on the lunar surface to say, you know, here's what I like. But the other surprise they had, in a sense, how fine-grained everything was and how, due to the solar radiation, how it had a charge. And so the dust would stick to their spacesuits, and they had a very difficult time getting that dust off. In fact, that night when they slept on the moon, let's see, I think Buzz Aldrin slept on the floor of the lunar module, and Mike Neil slept on the ascent stage of the of the limb. And the dust was so bad, they slept in their spacesuits.
I read that, yeah. Yes. And Buzz Aldrin once said that the lunar surface was dusty but not crunchy.
Right.
Yeah, interesting. So going back to John F. Kennedy, why did he want to send men to the moon and then return them safely to Earth? What was his motivation?
Well, the motivation came from October 4th, 1957, when the Sputnik went over. And that caused quite an alarm in the United States. I remember I was my second month of a freshman year at Park College at the time that that happened. And by hearing that beep, 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 people got concerned that the military, the intercontinental ballistic missiles, the atomic bomb that they had, that the our nation was, there was a great missile gap.
Mm-hmm.
And so to catch them, Kennedy, after meeting with a group of consultants, decided that this would be the tack to take, you know, to challenge them on the technological as well as the military, and that they didn't think that the Russians could catch us and go to the moon first.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Sputnik goes up. Everyone freaks out in America. And then you have the second Sputnik goes up just days later, and that causes concern. America tries to send a rocket up, a year or two later, and the thing implodes on the launch pad, basically. It was a pretty ugly beginning to America's space program.
Well, that was right. That was the Vanguard rocket that exploded. And it was an interesting time because Wernher von Braun wanted to have the opportunity to send the first spacecraft into space. And it was interesting that when the NASA Act in 1958 of July created the civilian agency called NASA. And at the time, Wernher von Braun was working for the Redstone Arsenal. And he was transferred to NASA, and at the time he was working on the Jupiter rocket, and the military wanted to keep it, so he moved over to NASA, and he thought, well, what would the name of the next rocket be? Well, Saturn's the next planet out, so that's how the Saturn name came into being.
Oh, that's interesting.
And and it had five engines, and that's where you get the Roman V. So that's how the Saturn V got its name.
That's interesting. But again, so when Kennedy challenges this country to go, I mean, the idea, we had a lot of work to do to get even in the ballpark in terms of being able to send men to the moon.
Right. One was training. You had to train all the astronauts in various ways. You had to create simulators. They had aircraft that would go up and do an arc and create microgravity where they could float around in the airplane and practice that. They had underwater, you know, buoyancy. And Buzz Aldrin was a great advocate that underwater you could simulate space much better. And today it's a very common practice for the astronauts to go underwater and practice, you know, the things that they're going to do in space. They had to learn how to rendezvous with another spacecraft. And that was a new technique, and that was one that I think that the Soviets were really pressed to do. They didn't understand all that. But a lot of people don't realize that Buzz Aldrin went to MIT and got his doctorate, and it was on the topic of rendezvous. So he was known as Dr. Rendezvous with the astronauts.
And then there's the whole matter of computers.
Yes.
We weren't very far along back in those days.
No, the computer was very, very primitive. In fact, it was very limited, and it could get overloaded quite quickly, as it did on the landing on the Apollo 11. But it was interesting, and people don't realize also that at the top band, just below where the lunar module was on the Saturn V, was the instrument ring, which told every one of the stages, when do you fire, when do you jettison, and where do you go. So that instrument ring was very instrumental in the first 12 minutes of flight and getting the astronauts into orbit around the Earth.
So Kennedy commands the country, in a sense, to move ahead with a space program. And we were motivated in large part, as you're saying, by the threat from the Soviets. It's hard to appreciate today just how scary the idea was that the Soviets might be getting ahead of us, right, and what that might mean for the future of the country.
I know. I can remember, I think it was at Clay Coma. I was at Munger School. And at the time, we always practiced atomic bomb, where you practice getting onto your desk.
Yes,
and
I remember doing that.
Could see a lot of pictures of people doing that.
Yeah.
So, in fact, Kennedy had approached Nikita Khrushchev about sharing going to the moon.
Is that right?
Yes, he did. And at first, Nikita Khrushchev said no, but the more he began to respect Kennedy, and he was willing to do it, but unfortunately, the assassination of Kennedy prevented that from happening.
So it's possible the world's two big superpowers could have linked arms,
exactly,
in the space program.
Right.
Oh, that's amazing. What's amazing to me too, Lynn, is in reading about all this is just how costly this mission wound up being. I mean, we're talking an extraordinary commitment by this country to get this thing done.
Yes, I think during the highest part of the I think it was something like $200 a citizen in the United States. The whole Apollo program cost $25.4 billion, and that's from when it started to where it ended. And that's about $180 billion, I think, at today's dollars.
Hmm.
But at the same time, people don't realize that for every dollar, NASA has what's called spinoffs. In other words, they had to create all these medical devices to measure the astronauts in space, which then transferred to the public. And that the people that do the spinoffs have recognized that for every dollar that NASA got, there's at least a $7 to $21 return in the economy.
Because these devices, you're saying, went into private practice and regular consumers began to benefit from these
things. And the microchips, a lot of things in medicine, because the astronauts, they didn't like all the space medicine, but it proved a lot of different things. And one of the things that people don't realize, if you look at the picture just before the astronauts get in the van to go over to get on the Saturn V rocket, they all have looks like a little suitcase next to them. But what NASA learned and what they did was that 2 hours before the launch, the astronauts had to breathe pure oxygen to rid the body of nitrogen, because otherwise they might get the bends. Because on the atmosphere, we have about 14.6 pounds of air pressure, but in the command module, it's only 5 pounds. So it's just a little difference, but that was enough to cause, I think, Mike Collins, both on the Gemini 10 mission and on the Apollo 11 mission, had a slight case of the bends in his knees. And it was just pain. It wasn't dramatic where it would tear the blood vessels apart. But that's why they have to purge. I mean, that's the kinds of things you never think of.
I never knew what those suitcases were for. Now I know. I always used to wonder, what's in those things?
It's
pure oxygen,
you're saying, that they have to breathe for 2 hours.
You know, we were talking about the computerization or the lack of it back in those days. I've read, Lynn, that the Apollo 11 astronauts would actually double check the computer's calculations at times using their own handheld instruments while they were up in space. Do I have that right?
Yes, especially when it came to knowing where they were in orbit. They had, like Mike Collins went to Morehead Planetarium and learned to identify stars. And believe it or not, on the Apollo mission to the moon, they used paper star charts. And what he would do is to look at these stars and get them to line up so that their edge was up just next to the Earth. And from taking a couple of measurements, they could then determine, you know, where they were in their orbit. So they used those primitive techniques. And the other thing, when they
talk— That just astonishes me.
Yes. And the other thing that people don't think of, that— you know, you hear a train come towards you and it makes a different noise when it goes away. They could use this red shift and blue shift, change a frequency in the radio signals to also tell a lot about where the astronauts were.
Oh, that's interesting. Dr. Lynn Bondurant is my guest. He'll present The Legacy of Apollo 11, 50 years and still counting, on Saturday, 50 years to the day that the lunar module Eagle landed on the moon. The event begins at 8:30 in the morning, folks, 8:30 at Union Station's Rainier Extreme Screen Theater. More information at unionstation.org. You know, Lynn, most of us today, you know, look at Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins as heroes. Do you regard them the same way, having worked with them?
I think they're superhumans.
Mm-hmm.
I've met all three. In fact, I worked for Mike Collins for 3 years. He was my boss at the Air and Space Museum. And I thought Neil Armstrong was a perfect person to be the first person to step on the moon. He was humble. He was very thorough. He was a great test pilot. And again, after he died in August of 2012,
right,
a lot of people don't know that he had a burial at sea. He did not want to be buried, you know, where people would keep coming to the cemetery to see. So he chose, and he was in the Navy in the past, and that's how he chose to be buried.
Do you think we should regard them that way, as heroes?
I do. I think we need people to look up to, especially the young people. And you have people that go out of their way, you know, that take that step beyond the challenge to dare to do what they may not have ever thought of, and to see what it takes to be a hero, the number of hours that they spent training, the things they had to do, you know. And once you become a hero, I always think of Neil Armstrong, one of the funniest things I ever think that happened to him. After he left NASA, he eventually ended up at being an aeronautical engineering professor at the University of Cincinnati.
Yes.
And he lived in Lebanon, Ohio, not too far from where I live. And he used to go to get a barbershop in Lebanon to get a haircut. And then he ran the paper where the barber was selling his clippings for his hair, and he got $3,000 for them.
Oh, you're kidding
no,
me.
No, and then Neil asked him to give the $3,000 to charity, and the barber had already spent the money, so I don't know whatever happened. But, yeah. But you know, people don't realize when you become a hero, every place they went, people wanted their autographs. They, you know, you can't go out in public, really, without being approached.
Recognized, for, yeah. Yeah. Well, you said you worked for Michael Collins for 3 years. How did Michael Collins wear the cloak of celebrity?
As a boss, he was very humble. He was very kind. He was very considerate of everybody, and was just a good representative of everybody that ever came to the National Air and Space Museum. I remember the day it opened in 1976. They sent a signal to Mars, to the Viking spacecraft, that sent a signal back, and when they got it back, the scissors were cut by a signal from Mars.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
Hey, how were these three men selected at the time? Obviously for what everyone knew was going to be an historic mission.
Right. Generally, you become a backup crew for each mission. Each mission has a backup crew. In case there's a problem, somebody can step in and fly the mission. And so they had both all served as backup crew members. And then Deke Slayton called Neil Armstrong into his office and told him that he would like him to be the commander on the Apollo 11 mission. And he mentioned who was going to be with him, you know, Mike Collins and Neil Armstrong. He said, now, do you want Neil Armstrong to be with you? Because he was not a favorite among the astronauts he's a very outgoing and a self-centered person in a way that.
Oh, who are you talking about now?
Buzz Aldrin.
Buzz Aldrin, right.
Mm-hmm. So, but to Neil Armstrong's credit, he came back the next day and told Deke Slayton, yes, I want him to be on the crew.
You know, I've read, Lynn, that there was a tussle of sorts between Armstrong and Aldrin as to which man would actually be the first to step on the lunar surface. Obviously, the two of them knew that whoever was first would have his name etched into the history books forever. How was that decision made?
I think it was somewhat political because the way they were seated, if it was succeeding, they could have handed the spacesuit over. They could have moved the spacesuits around. I just think that those that wanted to have somebody that would represent them, and that's how they chose that person. I think
that Armstrong was sort of seen as maybe the better representative,
right.
And maybe the.
Right.
I've read that maybe Aldrin would have been the natural choice because he was sitting closer to the hatch
right,
or something.
Right.
But Armstrong was ultimately picked.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it affected Buzz Aldrin, and he came back, and he got depression and became an alcoholic and went through all the treatment, and he's okay now. But I think
he's been on the show years ago. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think it's – people don't realize the amount of pressure that those folks are under, you know. And
to be representing all the time,
right.
To always be on when
right,
you're out.
Right, because afterwards, they went on a tour to I think it was 27 countries and 45 cities. You know, representing NASA, it was a goodwill tour, it was Apollo, and to go through that. And the people were so dedicated that there were about 400,000 people that helped on the Apollo program. And they were so conscientious that they would work 12, 15 hours a day. But it resulted in alcoholism, it resulted in depression, it resulted in divorces. So it was a big commitment of our nation to do that in that short time.
Lynn Bondurant's my guest. We're talking about the history of the Apollo 11 flight, the historic Apollo 11 flight. He's a 2016 inductee into NASA's Glenn Research Center Hall of Fame. If you have questions for Lynn, 816-235-2888 is our number. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. What type of training did the Apollo astronauts go through, Lynn? Do you have any feel for that?
They went through a lot of training. towards the end, they went through enough geology training that I think everyone that went through it could have had a master's degree in geology.
Wow.
They went out in the deserts. They went to Arizona, to practice what it would be to identify the rocks. So I think the geological training was intense. They had the first ones, they had to go to Panama and be in a jungle and do jungle survival.
Because why?
In case they landed in a jungle.
In the wrong place.
Right.
One of the Russian cosmonauts landed in the wrong place once.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then they also went to a desert. And they had to use the parachutes, to provide the kind of the protection to get them back. It was out in Nevada where they did that.
Mm-hmm.
They did water rescue. They did everything that you can imagine that you have on a mission. They practiced setting up the flag, for example, that's on the moon. They practice collecting the rocks. They collect everything that's gone. As I mentioned, the simulators. They had a centrifuge that they take the high G-forces because on liftoff, they go about 4.5 Gs. And on reentry, it's up to 6 Gs. So that's like somebody setting, six times the weight on your chest.
Right.
In fact, I think I read somewhere that as you get to the higher Gs, you can't breathe normal. You have to pant like a dog.
Is that right?
Right.
So they were panting like dogs as they were re-entering.
Yeah, probably.
Tell us about the rocket used to launch the Apollo 11 astronauts.
That was a Saturn V rocket. It had three stages, first, second, third stage. And then it had the instrument ring that I mentioned earlier.
Right.
And above that was the Apollo spacecraft. And that included the launch escape tower. And then it had the command module. And then underneath that was the service module. And then tucked underneath the inside panels was the lunar module. And so the Saturn V lifted off. It took about 2 seconds for it to get up to full speed. And once it lifted,
2 seconds?
2 seconds to get 7.5 million pounds of thrust. It was burning 45,000 pounds of fuel a second in the Saturn V, 45,000 pounds a second.
Yeah.
And it took about 11 seconds to clear the launch pad. And once it did, it took 12 minutes to get to orbit. And so it was a marvelous creation. I think, in my mind, the Apollo program was an engineering triumph.
Mm-hmm.
And I always remember what Neil Armstrong said, science can tell us what is, but engineering can tell us what can be.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really a masterful piece in engineering.
Well, those numbers, those stats you just threw out are just incredible, and it speaks to the courage of those men to sit atop a burning candle like that, that could ignite, in the wrong way any second.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it took courage.
816-235-2888. We're talking about the Apollo 11 flight. Let's go to some calls here. And Frank from Lawrence.
Hi, Dr. Bondurant. I'd like you to tell us what you know about Mike Collins, who was in the capsule along going around the moon but did not go down, and he was concerned about what would happen to him if the two astronauts were somehow stranded on the moon and could not get back, and I'll take your answer off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a great question, Frank.
Well, thank you.
What would have happened? Yeah.
Well, Mike Collins was quite concerned that if something happens, he would be the only one returning. If you want to read more about this, his book is called Carrying the Fire. To me, it's the best Apollo book written.
Oh, is that right?
He is he's quite a writer. He wrote the book himself. I think I heard when I was at the Smithsonian that the editors didn't even have to make many changes to what he was saying. Hmm. So he was quite concerned about that. And the other thing that I would mention—
Would he have been able to return safely, Lynn?
Yes, he would have.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was the command module pilot. He knew everything about the command module. He knew every button on there, that he could do. What people may not know that before they went up, they were worried about having finances for their families when they come back. So what they did, they signed 1,000 first day covers, and Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins, and then they divided them up. And I looked on the internet the other day, and I think they're going for about $90,000 now.
Oh, my gosh.
So they were concerned.
These are stamps you're talking about.
No, it's an envelope
with
their signatures on each of the, all three signatures on each envelope. And so, Frank, he was concerned. You know, he just worried that he had a, I think he had a, there's something he must have kept around his neck, a booklet that I think had about 100 and plus things he would do to try to rescue them if he could.
No kidding.
Yes. So he was most concerned about that.
Let's go back to some calls. And Don from Kansas City, Missouri. Don, good morning to you.
Good morning. And Dr. Vondran, in speaking of the courage of the astronauts and their heroic dimension, the physical courage that it took to sit on top of that bomb of a rocket and then to descend on the moon and what is really a flimsy little craft.
If right.
I was at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, right. D.C., and that lander looks like it's made of baling wire and aluminum foil.
Well, you're not far off.
And it looks like, it seriously looks like a contraption that you could stick your boot through if you weren't careful. And anyway, I think it's just amazing that they could
pull it off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead, Len.
I was going to say that the lunar module was probably the most difficult of any of the objects to create for the landing. Number one, they didn't know till later what their weight limitation would be. That was a key factor. And the second thing that came along was Mylar. And so the very bottom of that is all Mylar, and it has a sheet of aluminum on the upper ascent stage as well. So it worked out well. And of all the objects, or of all the missions, there was never one problem with the lunar module.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done at the Grumman factory in New York City.
You know, how important were the rocks that they gathered on the moon? I mean, what did those rocks prove? What value did they prove to have?
Well, nobody knew at the time what the rocks would entail. In fact, on the Apollo 11 mission, they collected 47.5 pounds of rocks. And actually, they collected 50 individual rocks. And then they had a whole bunch of loose material. And it all has gone back to the Lunar Receiving Lab, which is at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. And believe it or not, they looked at every little particle and every rock. In fact, there was some concern that that because of the lunar rocks, when the first time it would be exposed to oxygen, it might catch on fire.
Yes.
And I've read, I don't know if it's all true, but I heard one, they were kind of chuckling when they did start up the oxygen. But the other one I heard that they did put some of the contingency sample on the ascent stage to turn off the oxygen. They did it slowly to make sure that it mm-hmm. didn't catch fire. But the rocks have actually enabled us to learn about the moon. In fact, of all the lunar samples collected, about 70% are still in storage at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. Mm. And they just selected nine new teams this year, and each team will get a different piece of the lunar rock. The reason they've done that, because everybody knows that scientific instrumentation will improve, and so something else will come along that will help them assay the rocks differently than they ever did before.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the tiny little pieces in there, it was a piece of an orthosite, which is aluminum and calcium. In the formation of the moon, the magma rises to the top, and those objects that were found in the Apollo 11 almost give certain proof that the Earth was impacted by a Mars-sized object years ago, and the material knocked off of that formed a coalesce to create the moon.
That's interesting. So, ultimately, was it worth it, Lynn? I mean, I can't help but note that President Nixon wound up cutting back the number of Apollo missions, and once Armstrong set foot on the moon, the interest in the space program seemed to ratchet back, at least in the public's eye. There didn't seem to be another mission at hand to galvanize the public's attention again. I mean, Mars wasn't really being talked about, at least too actively, so the thing seemed to sort of fade away after we achieved this grand goal here.
Yeah, because people said we did it once, why watch it again?
Yeah.
And I think that's a problem with our country. Is that we don't, you know, we change our mind all the time, our priorities. And I think in elections, I even at NASA, I noticed that you get one group come in and they want you to do this. And Obama, I think, cut the moon program wanted to go to Mars. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration comes in, we're not going to Mars, we're going to the moon. And so you don't get long-term support of research in this country because we keep changing directions all the time.
So the current thrust is to go back to the moon. Do I understand
that's
that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
But the equipment they're building, they could be used on the Mars as well.
So what should this country, in your view, be thinking about when it comes to continuing the space program?
Well, I think that's our future. The oceans of space are our future. That's where we have to go. There's so many things that can be done. For example, the asteroid belt. The asteroids have probably enough minerals and rare minerals that each one of us could be billionaires with if they brought them all back, that they could supply. The moon, for example, has helium-3. Helium-3 is a great resource for energy that a tank full of that could probably power Kansas City for a month or so.
Wow.
And so, wow. I mean, there's all sorts of things that we could do on the moon that we don't know. And what I'd like to do is to put a telescope on the backside and actually, before I disappear from Earth, to make contact with intelligent life somewhere else.
Wow. That'd be a dream of yours.
That'd be a dream of mine.
That's Dr. Lynn Bondurant, a 2016 inductee into NASA's Glenn Research Center Hall of Fame. Again, he speaks on Saturday morning, tomorrow morning, 8:30 in the morning, to commemorate this 50th anniversary of the landing of Apollo 11 on the moon. All this will take place at Union Station's Rainier Extreme Screen Theater. More information, unionstation.org. Lynn, it's always great to have you here.
Well, thank
Thanks for the great, enlightening conversation.
Well, thank
I appreciate
you very
it.
Much, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll meet a Kansas City artist, Benjamin Todd Wills, who employs a balloon-powered, camera-equipped aircraft to create images, but not just any image. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we talked about affordable housing in the suburbs and what towns in this country are doing to expand moderately priced living outside of urban centers. Listen to that and other previous conversations. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, we look at toxic masculinity and femininity to learn what they are and who they affect and society's role in perpetuating these labels. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the idea for Kansas City artist Benjamin Todd Wills is to employ a balloon-powered, camera-equipped aircraft to create images, but not just any images. Wills's vision is to create pictures that recall history's great impressionists like Monet, Alfred Sisley, and Camille Pissarro. How did this happen? I'm not sure either, but we're about to find out as Benjamin Todd Wills joins me here in the studio just a day before he launches his third aircraft from the Central Library's fifth floor rooftop terrace. Benjamin, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, I watched some of your video online and I'm still a little confused. How do you go from balloon-powered aircraft to making images that resemble the great Monet's work? Hey, help me out here.
So I think that it's made in the same spirit as Monet or Pissarro. These impressionist painters were interested in capturing the light and movement and kind of the living ether that kind of
yes.
exists. So really what I'm trying to do is make art that interacts with the atmosphere and interacts with the land. And so as I launched these,
I was going to say, how do you do it?
Right. Yeah. So
that's the hard part, right?
It was the hard part. And so I knew for a long time that I wanted to be able to video the Earth from really high. And so attaching a camera to a weather balloon was a really simple kind of idea to mm-hmm. have, you know. And I really love, you know, the difference between having a weather balloon and a drone is that I'm not in control of the craft, right? So when I release it, it's up to the wind, it's mm-hmm. up to the condensation, to the weather, to really push it to wherever it's going to go.
So the art you create is purely naturally made then.
That's right. So mm-hmm. we set up a parameter. So attached to the craft is also a box that has a canvas inside of it and a bouncy ball that's covered in oil paint. And so while this okay. thing travels through, so it's going to get up to 95,000 feet. And the voyage is going to take maybe 4 hours on the long end, and it's going to move upwards of 150 to 200 miles away, and we'll have zero control once we let it go. And so when it hits a little turbulent bump or when it starts to spin, we get to sort of see, not only will we watch the video, the camera keep on climbing in altitude, and,
right,
and Kansas City will become tiny, and then you won't be able to see it, and it'll get high enough that we can see the curvature of the Earth.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so why do you want to do this? Where did this come from?
I think that the idea of making with the Earth and kind of making something that I'm not in complete control of is alluring to me, but also using what's already in my studio. If you see a picture of these crafts too, it's all made out of kind of the detritus of my studio or just what's around. You know, there's a lot of foam, there's a lot of scrap wood, and then, you know, kind of small, cheaper cameras, you know. And so being able to make something that'll go up 95,000 feet, maybe just the challenge of trying to do something with what I already have, something that's really man-made, really simple, but can do something that I think is a little bit magical.
Well, the launch that you're undertaking Saturday at the Downtown Central Library about noon is Pissarro 3, which suggests you've done this a couple of times already. What's been the result? What kind of art did this mission create, and how satisfied were you with it?
So I've been, I've been satisfied enough to do it now a third time.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think that the experience that comes from I'm learning, and the project evolves each time. So the first one traveled from Topeka to north of Kansas City, and it's attached to a GPS transmitter that lets me know every 2 minutes where it's at, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, it landed in the backyard of a couple, right?
Yes,
so,
I read that. Yeah.
So being able to drive up to their house and say, like, "Hi,
hello,
can I go into your backyard?"
And
they were so excited.
Did they know it had landed?
They
backyard?
Did. So they were riding around in a riding lawnmower, taking care of their yard. Really quick to back it up.
Yeah.
When it hits like 95,000 feet, the balloon will burst, and then it parachutes back to the Earth.
Oh, okay.
So it'll parachute down in, you know, maybe 6 minutes. It comes down, obviously, a lot faster than it goes up, right? and it landed really high up in a tree.
I saw the picture. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And so I had to, and it was too high to climb the tree. The tree was too thin. So I had to end up standing atop of a ladder with a string tied to a rock and sling it.
Oh,
up
you're
and
kidding.
Yeah, and pull it down, and David and Robin, the people that own the house, they were like in the backyard cheering for me, and they were like super interested in the whole thing. And so it was, that experience, and like having people that it happens across be so interested in it.
Yes,
you know, fuels you to want to do it again immediately.
You know, different things caught my attention about what you're trying to do. And one thing was just how fast this thing traverses the Earth once it actually gets up in the sky. It went a long way in a pretty short period of time, which I guess says a lot about wind currents and all that stuff up high. But that kind of amazed me. Did it surprise you?
It surprised me. I drove out to Topeka thinking that it might land in Lawrence.
Well, yeah, right.
Right.
I mean,
but
that's what I would have thought too.
Right. So, with the first one that flew, it flew in a really straight pattern, and so it flew really quick. So, the second time when we launched the second one, I was thinking, well, I can fall. I actually, because it dings to my phone like where it's at. So I was like, we can probably follow it in the car because it just goes in a straight line. But the second one wove all around, and it ended up in near Joplin.
Huh.
And we lost it to the light. So we had to actually drive home and then go back in the morning. And instead of being in the backyard, we had to hike and go find it in the middle of the woods somewhere.
So what did you do with the art that was produced from the first two flights?
So the art gets framed. So both of those images remain. So you end up with this really kind of abstract, kind of like almost like dotted and pointed painting that we still have. And I'll show those around, and I'll recover the crafts and show like what is left of the craft after I recover
it. It's not real big.
No. So to legally do this, Mm-hmm. It has to be.
I was going to ask.
Yeah, there's a size and there's a weight that it has to be under. So these crafts are 1 inch shorter than what they legally can be, and they're 1 ounce lighter than they.
So you can do this without getting permission from like NASA or something like that.
Right. Yeah. You can do so. If it was just a little bit more, I would have to register it, mm-hmm. right, in weight or in size. So, but they're really small and they're so lightweight that the velocity from it falling is never going to really be harmful.
Are you going to sell the art?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's so many different ways that it kind of works. It's a video project. It's a painting project. It's the actual craft is kind of a sculpture. Mm-hmm. And this time will be the first time that it's performed live, the launch. So it'll be the first time it becomes performance art as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right now the hope is to have a show that kind of shows all the different missions. We're going to do another one in a month and kind of take we also collect samples from like the soil from
yes,
where we launch
where,
and we do a compare and contrast about you know like where it started and how it ended up.
Kansas City artist Benjamin Todd Wills is my guest. His Pissarro 3 launch will take place noon Saturday at the downtown library, the Central Library at 14 West 10th Street. You know, how much interest is there in things like this? We just talked about NASA, obviously, and the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. And this sort of conjures up some of that same imagination and fantasy and all those kinds of ideas. What does it do? How much interest do people have in what you're trying to do?
I think that it's a pretty accessible project because
yeah.
of just how many different components there are, how homemade it looks, and how simple it has been to be able to participate in this kind of flight and, you know, leaving the Earth kind of expedition. You know, I think, I mean, if I could get one of these, if I could build something that went into space, I mean, that would be obviously very exciting for me.
Right.
So I settle with the thermosphere just because I know how to get it to there. But it's always, you know, how can I go up a little bit higher? That's really what pushes the project, you know?
That's interesting. How do you, what do you use to raise this thing off the Earth?
So I'll use helium.
Helium. Just that simple.
Yeah, it's balloon helium. So it's, you know, it's.
And it'll go how high again?
It'll go over 90,000 feet.
90,000 feet.
It's an 8-foot balloon. So if you come to the launch, you'll see it'll take one person that's operating the tank and then two people to stabilize the balloon as we are blowing it up. And that's also, you know, something that we learned along the way, too, that it takes a crew to really do this. The first one was just two people on a super windy day, and it almost was the end of the whole project before it started.
You know, one of your other projects I couldn't help but notice on your website, Benjamin, stemmed from the letters you wrote to inmates in solitary confinement. What drew you to those inmates specifically, and what were you trying to do there?
So I think that working with inmates is really...
It's been a focus of yours for years now.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for about 8 years, I've been working on a project where I communicate with people who have been incarcerated for long stretches of time. And I think that there's a wanting to connect with somebody who has been displaced has been a significant driver for me. The first few letters that I wrote, I was writing to people who I knew that were incarcerated, and they encouraged me to write to some people that hadn't received letters in a really long time from anybody. And sort of the content that I was getting back from these strangers became the fuel for that work. So it was so easy to read sort of their desire to connect
right.
with somebody on a human level, their desire to be heard or to just have a baseline human connection.
I was going
to
say, what kinds of things did they say to you that got you thinking about doing something artistically with what you were getting?
So I think that, you know, I'm constantly making, and that project didn't start as an art project, but just as writing to my friends that were in prison. And so I think that kind of what you know, happens to me more often than not is when I'm trying really hard on a project, the thing that I'm doing that I don't think is art turns into my thing, right?
Yeah.
So it was through conversations that I was having that I wasn't thinking were art that the whole project was kind of born. I received a paper airplane in the mail from a kind of a pen pal that I had had, and he wrote, as far as art goes, or as sculpture goes, this is the best we can do in prison. And so...
A
paper airplane, right.
That became one of your muses.
That became
the
first paper airplane. So after I received that, I started, you know, at the end of every letter, I would say, if you have time, would you make me a paper airplane? And so now the collection's over 500. We had a show here.
And you mounted them all, right?
Yeah. So I show them all together. Each airplane kind of takes each airplane has its own personality. I never ask for someone to decorate an airplane or to do anything. I just write, if you have time, will you send me a paper airplane? And what I get back is just they so want to participate in an exercise
something.
Of expression, right?
Yes,
and so,
right.
So what's really great about that project, or one of the parts that I really love about the project, is that I photograph it every time it's installed, and I turn that photograph into postcards that go back to the people that have participated. So if you sent me an airplane, if you're one of the first 20 that I showed, you've watched the project grow for the last 6 years. So even if you're in solitary confinement, you can be a part of a project that's living, that's growing, mm-hmm. that moves. It's right now, it's in Philadelphia at Eastern State Penitentiary through the end of the year.
And what's there, all the paper airplanes?
All the paper airplanes, right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I look for opportunities for, you know, people who have, I love when family members of incarcerated people can come in and experience it and see a loved one who's, you know, being able to still participate in some kind of togetherness.
You know, you also came up with a project related called A Lifer's World. Describe that to us, because that was interesting to me, too.
So A Lifer's... So they send me paper airplanes, but they also... inmates send me everything. If it's in prison and it can move through the mail, I've received it.
And you get diagrams of what these cells look like.
Yeah. They draw me their cells all the time. So... So ultimately, I was getting so many drawings of prison cells, and I started seeing a lot of repeated imagery. There's the really like the institutional long and skinny window, and there's mm-hmm. the toilet that's also a sink, and there's mm-hmm. the mirror and the slot for food to come through a door, and the bed, like it creates its own sort of iconography and visual language. So,
and you actually sort of transfer that to two walls that give people the sense of what it's like to actually be there, right?
So the images that you see online, it might look like two walls, but it's actually four walls that are on wheels, and you can close yourself into. So I'll take their drawings and make them. I'll project them onto the walls, and I'll paint their drawings and turn it into an actual, like, if they live in an 8x6 size cell, the room will be 8 feet by 6 feet, and their drawing will be life size.
I'm about out of time. Where can people go and see that?
At BenjaminTodWills.com.
Can they go see it in real life?
Oh, so no, that was just up in Kansas, just at the beginning of the year.
Okay, BenjaminTodWills.com. Okay. Pissarro 3 launch tomorrow at noon, the Central Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. Good luck with the weather. Good luck with the launch. I hope it goes well, Benjamin.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Next week on the show, Sam Zeff will be in the host chair looking at toxic humanity and cool foods to beat the heat. And KCUR will bring you live coverage of Robert Mueller's testimony next week on KCUR's Up to Date. Follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.